Today on the 21st Show, private equity companies are not household names to most Americans, but they touch so many parts of our lives, from housing to newspapers to healthcare. Journalist Megan Greenwell writes about what that means for our economy and the people working on the front lines of it in her new book, Bad Company: Private Equity and the Death of the American Dream. Listeners, what questions do you have about private equity and how it works? Have you noticed or felt the impact of private equity companies on your life? Our number is 800-222-9455. I'm Christine Herman, in for Brian Mackey with Megan Greenwell for the hour, today on the 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in Rockford, DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, the news from NPR. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Christine Herman, in for Brian Mackey this week. Remember this?
I don't want to grow up. I'm a Toys R Us kid. There's a million toys at Toys R Us that I can play with. From fight to trains to video games, it's the biggest toy store there is.
So whatever happened to Toys R Us, and what about Joann Fabrics or Party City? Some would argue that private equity ownership played a substantial part in all three of those businesses going under. Christopher in Brimfield in our texting group summed it up. He says, just look at the businesses that have closed because of private equity. They are not in a business to make a company grow. They're in business to strip all the money out of a business and then close it. Thanks for that message, Christopher. It turns out that the reach of private equity firms goes far beyond retail. Private equity owns hospitals, apartment complexes, daycare centers, nursing homes, and even newspapers like Illinois' famed Chicago Tribune. And the top priority of those private equity firms is making money, even if that means hollowing out those institutions in the process. Journalist Megan Greenwell says those who lose out are the companies that rely on those institutions and the workers who depend on jobs at those businesses for their livelihoods. Megan is based in New York. She's written or edited for a number of publications from the New York Times to the Washington Post to Wired, and she's written an entire book on the effects of private equity on our lives and the companies with which we do business. It's called Bad Company: Private Equity and the Death of the American Dream. It's available now from HarperCollins, and joining me now for the hour to talk about all of this is Megan Greenwell. Megan, welcome to the 21st Show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Listeners, our phone lines are open throughout the hour if you want to join the conversation at 800-222-9455. Have you noticed private equity in your life? What questions do you have about how it works? And are you worried about the effect that private equity firms have on our economy? Our number, 800-222-9455. So, Megan, tell us a little bit about what makes this story personal for you.
Yeah, I had covered so many things in my journalism career, but I had never covered business or economics. And I didn't know much about private equity myself until it came into my life. I was the editor-in-chief of a sports publication called Deadspin. That was really my dream job once I got there in 2018. Yes. That was the only place I wanted to be. And about a year and a half into my tenure there, we got taken over by a Boston-based private equity firm called Great Hill Partners. And I was pretty optimistic at first. We needed to be acquired. We needed our business side to be strengthened. We were profitable, but there was a lot of room to grow. And so I was excited until pretty immediately everything started going wrong. They were telling us to cut some of our most profitable types of content. They were really questioning my leadership, but unable to really pinpoint what exactly they were criticizing. And so I left that job after about 3 months of our private equity ownership. The rest of my staff followed me out the door 2 months after that. And it really just got me very interested in why does private equity work this way? You know, why was my once thriving publication now a shell of its former self. And so I really started reporting the book because I was just personally obsessed with these questions.
And for those who aren't well-versed in this, as I certainly wasn't before I read your book, how does private equity ownership make its money, kind of in broad strokes, if you could kind of lay that out for us?
Yeah, so the basic payment structure of any private equity firm is known as 2 and 20. The 20 is that the private equity firm gets 20% of all profits over a certain threshold. That's relatively unobjectionable because it's performance-based, right? The company has to succeed for that to work. But the 2 is the firm gets 2% of the total deal value as a management fee every single year, no matter how the company is doing. So you can be in the process of driving the company into the ground and still make 2% of the total deal annually. A lot of these deals are, you know, $5, $6, $10 billion. And so 2% every year is a pretty nice sum. Then you can make all this other money through bonuses from acquiring more companies and rolling them up into a bigger conglomerate. You can take what are called dividend recapitalizations, which pay the private equity firm. You can sell off your portfolio company's real estate and pocket the profits, and then charge your own portfolio company rent for the exact same land they previously owned. So what you end up with is this sort of split in incentives where what is good for me as the private equity firm is not necessarily what's good for my own portfolio company. And in some cases, the incentives are literally the opposite. As in the case of selling the real estate, I am strengthening myself quite literally by weakening my portfolio company.
So it sounds so counterintuitive that the business that has been acquired can lose money, even go bankrupt, and yet the private equity firms are making money. Is that an accurate summary of what you laid out there?
Yes, that's exactly right. And I think that does surprise a lot of people. And I've heard a lot of people who haven't read my book kind of assuming that it's making the argument that we should just burn down the entire capitalist system. In fact, I argue that this is contrary to what we think of as American free market capitalism, because the firm can very easily profit by tanking its own portfolio company. So you don't need to build a business in order to make money for yourself. And that does not feel to me like what America's version of free market economics was designed to do.
And what do you think it is about private equity that makes it, you know, as you write about in your book, America's most consequential and yet least understood economic force? It intersects with our lives in so many ways. And yet I think a lot of people are like, private equity, I don't really know what that is.
Yeah, this is a system that is very secretive by design. So the private in the name refers to the sources of capital, but it's also a really good moniker for explaining how little private equity firms need to disclose regulatory-wise. They have to publish a lot less information than other kinds of companies. And they also have gone to great lengths to make sure that journalists, workers, ordinary people don't really understand what they're doing. So a lot of their maneuvers are cloaked in, you know, shell company under shell company. One thing I heard over and over again from workers is until everything went wrong, they didn't know that their company was owned by private equity. And why would they, right? If you worked for Toys R Us, you know, as a rank and file worker, your bosses 7 or 8 levels above you all worked for Toys R Us. Your paycheck said Toys R Us. And so unless you were going to do a lot of digging, you wouldn't necessarily know that ultimately the shots were being called by Bain Capital and KKR, not by Toys R Us executives at all. So, you know, sometimes people come up with to me with some sense of embarrassment or shame that they don't really understand this. And the thing I always say is like, No, they have gone to great lengths to make sure you don't. And a lot of what I wanted to do in writing this book was through human stories, show people that this is actually not incomprehensible. It's just that the private equity firms want you to think that it is.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce my guest. This is the 21st Show. I'm Christine Herman, and my guest for the hour is Megan Greenwell, a journalist who wrote a book about private equity and the way it has shaped and continues to shape the American economy and American workers. You can join the conversation at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Megan, I want to share with you a text from one of our listeners. Tony in Champaign texted us to say, I always pay attention to this kind of inquiry as to how the markets operate. Clearly, we don't need to enhance how the rich are getting richer. I personally wonder how these funds affect the worth of pension funds, like, for example, the State University's retirement system of Illinois. And I'd like to know if they're getting unwarranted tax advantages. Thanks for that message, Tony. And Megan, I don't know if you can speak specifically to what's happening in Illinois, but generally speaking, what can you say about pension funds and this question about tax advantages that these companies get? Can you talk a little bit about that?
It's such an astute question because pension funds are the biggest investors in many private equity firms. And so what private equity firms often say to defend what they do is, yes, we're working for public employees. We are trusted with the money of teachers and firefighters and police officers and nurses and all of these folks who, you know, we as a society think deserve to be able to retire. The research is super murky on whether private equity firms do generate better returns for pension funds than other kinds of investments. It's one of those areas where you can kind of make the numbers say whatever you want, but let's give them the benefit of the doubt and say that, yes, they get better returns from private equity than they do from just mutual funds or whatever. Even if that is true, there's something really canny going on here on the part of private equity firms where they have turned capitalism into this sort of zero-sum game for the rest of us, right? They're going to win either way. They're billionaires. For the rest of us, what they are saying is that the only way for this group of middle-class workers to win out, you know, the teachers, firefighters, etc., is for this other group of workers to lose. So I specifically asked the head of private equity at KKR, one of the biggest firms in the world, why can't you just raise the salaries of underpaid workers in the companies you buy? And he was almost horrified by my question. He said, no, of course I can't do that, because that is hurting the workers who have pensions in the pension funds. And I really had to sit with that to understand why it was so unsettling for me. And the reason is because he's saying, I will not pay more than the legally mandated minimum wage to this set of workers because I'm going to benefit this set of workers. Of course, nobody, not the teachers, the firefighters, anybody, benefits nearly as much from this system as the private equity executives themselves. And so what he is saying is, you all have to fight for the scraps while we, you know, feast on the elaborate meal. That's disconcerting to me. On the subject of tax breaks, there are so many tax breaks that allow private equity firms to keep more of their profits for themselves. The biggest one that has become a national conversation several times is called the carried interest loophole. And the simple version of this is it allows private equity profits to be taxed as potential profits rather than real money right now. And so the result of that is the tax rate for that type of money is much, much, much lower than for any other kind of company, much less you and I, right? How our incomes are taxed. And there have been plans to close the carried interest loophole several times. Barack Obama, Donald Trump the first time, Joe Biden, and now Donald Trump the second time have all proposed closing this carried interest loophole. And yet it has never gotten through Congress, in large part because 88% of members of the House and Senate take donations from private equity. And so even with, you know, presidents from both parties saying, look, we need to do this for fairness reasons, it has been a thing that nobody has been able to push through yet.
We just have a couple minutes before we got to take a break, but I want to ask about the growth of private equity and sort of the expansion, because the primary association initially was with retail, at least in the eyes of the public. What brought private equity so substantially into other sectors? And let maybe we can talk about healthcare specifically.
So often private equity firms get into a new industry when they see some sort of opening. And often that opening is either cheap money, low interest rates, or a new source of money. So with healthcare specifically, the Affordable Care Act was actually inadvertently the thing that really pushed private equity into that space, because all of a sudden so much more money coming out of healthcare was guaranteed, right? Because the federal government was essentially acting as a backstop for people who couldn't afford private insurance. And that led a ton of private equity firms to get really excited about hospitals, private practices, all sorts of other venues in the healthcare space. And in housing, it was a very similar thing, where the 2008 financial crisis pushed the cost of housing down. Theoretically, that was a good thing for ordinary Americans, especially with the backing of money from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who guarantee low interest loans for many first-time homebuyers. But there was nothing in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's policies to keep out huge financial firms. So the prices are going down. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac make money pretty cheap. And private equity firms saw, oh, this is a good chance for us. So they start snapping up all of these hospitals, all of these apartment buildings, all of these single family homes, all of these doctor's offices. And now all of a sudden, these policies that were created to help ordinary Americans are in fact benefiting the private equity firms.
And Megan, let me jump in here. We can pick this up on the other side of a short break. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Christine Herman. We're talking today about private equity, the often mysterious firms that take over companies and then cut costs to increase profits, sometimes at the cost of those companies going under while the firms still make money. We're talking about this with Megan Greenwell. She's a journalist and she's written a book about all of this. It's called Bad Company, Private Equity and the Death of the American Dream. It's available now wherever you get your books. If you have a question for Megan or thoughts on this topic, still plenty of time to join us. Our number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Megan, just before the break, you were explaining how private equity expanded into healthcare and also real estate, due in part because of opportunities that were there after the Affordable Care Act rollout and also the 2008 financial crisis. Go ahead and finish, pick it up from there and finish that thought.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting is back when private equity was in retail and, you know, other industries as well, but retail was one of the biggest. That was before areas like healthcare and housing were huge areas of investment. And what happened was there was this evolution because retail became a less fashionable industry for investment generally because of the rise of Amazon, et cetera. But you can see as they start to get bigger in areas like housing and healthcare, they're applying the exact same playbook that they established in retail. So I talked about selling off the real estate, which is a strategy known as sale leaseback agreements. And in the late 2010s, that started to be a huge tactic for private equity in healthcare. They would sell off the real estate from under hospitals, for example. And they took that strategy directly from what they had done earlier in retail. And so what's interesting to me is if you're a private equity firm, it almost doesn't matter whether you're talking about stores or hospitals or homes or whatever it is. They're all just widgets where you can look for what's fashionable in this moment, apply the same strategies and make your money off of whatever it is.
And we talked earlier about how private equity often makes its money through cuts of employees, of services, and more. And you've been hinting at that a little bit in your most recent answer there. But can you talk about some of the ways that you saw that happen in practice that you detail in your book?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are all sorts of ways people are hurt by the same strategies that allow private equity to make money. So raising prices is, of course, one of the biggest ones. You see that in retail, you see that in apartment buildings, rents will go up, the cost of care in hospitals will go way up. Also cutting a lot of staff. I reported on a rural hospital in Wyoming where the number of services that hospital could offer just got absolutely decimated once private equity took over. And in one case, there was a homicide in the hospital that was directly a direct result of understaffing, undertraining, and not enough security practices in place. And so in many cases, people are literally dying as a result of private equity investment, and the private equity firms are continuing to profit the whole way along.
And it's sort of like at that point in the situation, now it's clear that private equity's intervention is leading to these challenges and these issues, but it's almost too late at that point, right? The deal's already been made, the hospital has already been sold, and then it's just kind of downhill from there. Is that what you generally see happen?
I think that's right. Yeah. Like in my own experience, you know, by the time you realize there's a problem is well after the deal has been completed. And so if you're going to combat this in a serious way, it requires some combination of regulation, increased scrutiny on deals, limitations to what private equity can do when they do take over. But yes, at the point at which you're seeing negative effects in your own employer or community institution or landlord or whatever it is, it's pretty tough to push back in a real way.
Let's talk a little bit more about housing. So we got this text from Brandy in Urbana. Brandy says, I've noticed private equity firms buying houses and contributing to the affordable housing crisis by scooping up the supply and then renting it at really high rates. At the same time, they do little to care for the properties when their renters run into problems. How can we regulate this issue to ensure big conglomerates aren't exacerbating our ongoing affordable housing crisis? Thanks for that text, Brandy. And Megan, I want to dive into some of the regulation side of this later, but for now, maybe you can tell us a little bit about one of the subjects of your reporting, who was someone who did feel the effects of private equity on her housing experience firsthand. Tell us about her.
Yeah, I'm so grateful for this question because it does feel like there has started to be more awareness of private equity's role in the housing market. And there are some areas of the country, most notably Atlanta, where private equity is just buying up huge swaths of both single family housing and apartment buildings. So the housing section of my book is set in Northern Virginia, right outside DC, and focuses on a massive apartment complex, about 2,300 apartments. And the complex historically had catered primarily to African immigrants and refugees. It was just sort of one of those organic things that happened where a few people moved in, and then when new people came, they heard that this was a good place because maybe they had a friend of a friend there, and it just turned into a gathering place from a lot of folks from that area of the world. And when a private equity firm bought the complex in 2020, pretty immediately, these tenants started seeing negative effects. So there were all sorts of maintenance problems. And, you know, maintenance problems don't come out of nowhere. This was a complex that was built in the 1960s. And the private equity firm was saying, look, this is on the previous owners for not taking care of this stuff before we came in. But A, they made the choice to buy it. They took responsibility. And B, they were not doing anything to fix it. And so there's a pivotal moment in my book where 14 families' apartments were flooded so badly that they had to move out for a month or more. And when the private equity firm was asked about it, they said essentially, yes, well, this pipe broke. There were something like 60 different pipes, all of which were very worn out. And what are we going to do? Fix them all at once? They wouldn't do that because that would require giving up, you know, a month or two of rent, which was not an option for them. So there is a sense that private equity firms like to escape even basic maintenance for as long as they can in a way that really does put tenants at risk. And meanwhile, you know, in this apartment complex I wrote about, they were creating a yoga room and making the lobby look really fancy. And everybody had this sense that they were probably trying to cater to future Amazon workers, because Amazon is building its second headquarters in that area of Northern Virginia and trying to get these lower income tenants out. And so you walk in and everything looks very beautiful and very fancy. And then the pipes are all worn out, right? So it really is like, how much low cost cosmetic work can you do to disguise the fact that just beneath the surface, everything is at risk of falling apart?
If you're just joining us, this is The 21st Show. I'm Christine Herman. My guest for the hour is Megan Greenwell, a journalist who wrote a book about private equity and the way it has shaped the American economy. Her book is called Bad Company: Private Equity and the Death of the American Dream. You can still join our conversation, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Megan, there might be people who are listening and thinking, well, you know, this doesn't really affect me because I own my home, or I don't work for a company that's run by private equity. I wonder if you could talk about maybe the ripple effects of private equity entering a community, scooping up businesses beyond even the people who work for those companies that are acquired.
Yeah, I've heard exactly that line of argument so many times from folks. And unfortunately, I think the idea that private equity is not in your life is just a little bit naive at this point. So maybe they don't own your employer or your home, and that's great, but they are huge in dentist's office now, nursing homes, veterinary practices, even public utilities. They're getting very big into managing everything from toll roads to water utilities to bridges in many places. And so what I say to people when they say that is, I'm just afraid that if you don't think private equity is involved in your life, you really haven't looked hard enough yet. And if they're really not touching you at all, it probably is just a matter of time. But you mentioned ripple effects, and I also think that's incredibly important. There are all of these studies that show, for example, when local newspapers close, which has been, you know, something that private equity has done a lot of, people's tax rates increase because the municipalities get a lower bond rating because they don't have enough scrutiny on the activities of their government. And so if your local newspaper has closed, and many across Illinois have, particularly in smaller towns and rural areas, that is something where your tax bill may literally be higher as a result of that, and you just have no idea, right? And even if your, you know, let's say dentist is not owned by private equity, they are very likely pushing up the cost of your dental care because, you know, the competition is raising prices, so likely your dentist's office will do the same. And so this is really something that ends up touching absolutely everybody in multiple ways at this point, and that will only continue to grow.
So private equity likes to portray itself as something of a savior in the financial world. Its leaders say, you know, we save jobs, we increase productivity. Meanwhile, we heard from John in Harvard. He texted us to say private equity is about slaughter of business because they are worth more butchered than alive. Equity murders 90 businesses for every one they save, but the one saved is all the hedge funds we'll talk about. Thanks for that message, John. And Megan, where do you land on this? Is that 90-to-1 ratio correct?
I think that may be somewhat overstated. You know, I do not argue that private equity firms want to close the businesses they own. In most cases, they would make more of a profit if they had some sort of lucrative exit, right? So taking the company public or turning around and selling it again. But the issue is that they can afford to be a little apathetic as to whether they improve the business or not, because they will make some money either way. They are just taking on so little risk. Private equity firms do what they call leveraged buyouts, and the leverage is bank loans. And the trick with private equity is that those bank loans are assigned not to the firm, but only to the portfolio company. Which means that if the company declares bankruptcy, the private equity firm is not responsible for paying that money back. So firms do present themselves as these sort of swashbuckling heroes who can save companies when nobody else can. But the reality of the situation is less that they're trying to kill companies, but they've taken on so little risk that it doesn't really matter to them. And unfortunately, improving the fundamentals of a business is long, slow, difficult work. Private equity is by its nature a short-term game. And so they're not willing to invest that kind of money and energy. So the result is 10 times as many companies owned by private equity enter bankruptcy proceedings as other kinds of companies. So it is unequivocally true that the failure rate is much, much higher than any other kind of company, and that doesn't really negatively affect the private equity firms.
Is it safe to say that some of the companies that are scooped up by private equity firms, they were sort of at risk of going under anyway? So, you know, if I could be devil's advocate on that last point you made about, you know, they're at much greater risk of going out of business after acquisition, is it sort of like, well, it was kind of inevitable that Toys R Us wasn't going to survive once Amazon came along or something like that?
I think it is true that private equity firms take on more struggling companies than other kinds of investors would. But they are not sharing the risk for those companies. You know, so if this was a normal acquisition, they could say, look, the failure risk of Toys R Us is very high right now. We're not going to buy in. But because they can profit regardless of whether the company lives or dies, they can buy companies that they see to be at risk and then do nothing to try to fix them up. So if they really think they're too far gone, great, okay, don't buy them. But the result is they can buy them and make theirs anyway while screwing over, you know, in the case of Toys R Us, 33,000 workers across the country. Toys R Us is a really interesting example to me because they were struggling in the age of Amazon, but they were still profitable. So struggling means their trend line was down, but not that they were losing money. What caused them to, you know, actually start losing money was that they were assigned $5 billion in debt to finance this acquisition. Again, the private equity firms do not share any responsibility for that debt. And so all of the money that could be spent upgrading the in-store experience, creating a real functional online commerce business, all of these things that could have kept them in the conversation much longer and did work for many retail chains, right? Despite the dominance of Amazon, many retail chains are doing just fine. But none of the 25 or 30 top performing retail chains in the US are owned by private equity firms. And I think the reason for that is pretty clearly that taking on that level of debt does not leave enough money to try to become a, you know, thriving 2020s kind of company.
We're coming up on a short break here. I'll just read another text from Lloyd in Danville, who said private equity firms control many markets in conjunction with other privately held companies. But sadly, most people are unaware of the intricacies of how these companies operate and affect their purchasing power. Yes, hospitals and other institutions are affected with trickle down to us. We're going to take another break, but when we come back, we'll talk more about what people are doing in response to private equity's effect on the economy. We're talking with Megan Greenwell, author of Bad Company, Private Equity, and the Death of the American Dream. 800-222-9455 is the number if you'd like to join us. 800-222-9455. More to come. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. The 21st Show. I'm Christine Herman. We've been talking today about the effect private equity firms have on the American economy, especially when it comes to businesses that end up under that kind of ownership. Our guest is Megan Greenwell, a journalist and author of Bad Company, Private Equity and the Death of the American Dream. 800-222-9455 is the number to join us in the next 10 minutes or so. 800-222-9455. We've got a caller on the line, Meg in Mansfield. You've got a question. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. My question is in response to the comment of the guest about private equity and public works projects. And I've been wondering about the involvement in prisons. It's really just disturbing enough to see how privately run prisons have taken hold, and government just seems to be handing off these kinds of things that, you know, I would hope they'd be responsible for. So just wondering if prisons are in this conversation, and I'm really looking forward to hearing about what we can do about all this too. Thanks.
Thanks so much for your call, Meg. Megan, go ahead. What do we know about prisons and private equity?
Oh, it's such a good question. Yes, private equity is involved in running privately operated prisons, and that's another growing area of investment for them. And I think, Meg, you're exactly right. That is very worrisome on several levels. And even in public prisons, so federal, state, local, private equity often runs the service providers for those prisons. So a reporter named Robin Kaiser Schatzlein wrote a story for Mother Jones a couple of years ago about how private equity firms control most of the phone services companies that prisoners use to call their families. And so private equity firms, like you see with everything else, buy those phone service providers, hitch up the prices massively, and then incarcerated people can't afford to call their relatives. So yes, prisons are a huge area of involvement.
And to Meg's question about solutions, let's go ahead and dive into some of that. And you've mentioned there could be regulations that could potentially protect people and the broader society from some of the ill effects we've been talking about from private equity and acquisitions of businesses. But so, you know, if I could ask you the magic wand question, if someone in the federal government gave you a magic wand to wave to regulate this in such a way that would be maybe even potentially, you know, preserve the beneficial aspects that could come from private equity and eliminate some of the detrimental aspects, what would you do to make that happen?
If I could make one, you know, simple but powerful change, it would be to require parent firms to share responsibility for the debt they take on in their portfolio companies' names. So if I'm a private equity firm and I, you know, buy Toys R Us and take out $5 billion, I'm the decision maker there. I should be forced to share responsibility, not just make the decision for my portfolio company whose existence doesn't really matter to me one way or the other. That is a simple but radical change. You know, like I mentioned, 88% of members of the House and Senate take money from private equity. So I think that's a fairly unlikely change to be made. Elizabeth Warren has proposed a bill that she calls the Stop Wall Street Looting Act over and over and over since 2018, and it never comes anywhere close to getting out of committee. That bill would make the change I talked about, as well as many, many other huge changes to how private equity operates, without a pretty dramatic change in the composition of Congress. That's not going to get through, and nor is my idea. But there are things happening on the local level in several places, especially in healthcare. Several states in the last year or so have passed legislation increasing scrutiny of private equity deals in healthcare, or, you know, in some cases banning them altogether. And that feels like something optimistic to me, because sometimes we focus so much on what is being done or not done on the federal level that we forget that we do have other avenues of power, right? And so I have been encouraged by some of the movement happening on the state level in several places.
Your book focuses on four American workers who found themselves dealing with the effects of private equity ownership on four different entities: retail, hospitals, newspapers, and housing. And certainly you're very clear about what's happened to these companies and these workers, but your writing draws a line between something that connects all of them, which is that in one way or another, they've tried to fight back. Can you talk a little bit about how you saw that in action with the people who you highlight in this book?
I was very conscious of not wanting to end this book on, you know, a note of, wow, isn't this a terrible system? Now you're really depressed. Okay, bye. and so all four of my protagonists, I really chose them because they were fighting back in some interesting ways. So the most obvious one is lobbying for legislation. But there are all sorts of other creative solutions that they're working on. So one of them, who had worked for many years at Toys R Us, spent a lot of time flying around the country, speaking in front of pension boards, essentially saying, you know, please don't invest in these private equity firms until they commit to treating workers better. And that helped win a severance fund for the laid off Toys R Us workers. That was a huge deal. In hospitals, there are some really interesting things going on, ranging from lobbying to ban what they call the corporate practice of medicine, which means that only licensed physicians can own physician practices, to, in some cases, just starting entirely new institutions. I won't spoil the biggest reveal of the book because I think it's dramatic and interesting, but this group of workers in Wyoming did something really, really radical and successful to combat the death of their local hospital. In media and some other industries, that looks like reinventing industries from the ground up, right? We all know that media is plagued with problems in terms of the financials that private equity did not create, but private equity came in to profit off of them. And so there are all these folks in media saying, okay, maybe more of media should be nonprofit and should be philanthropy supported. And that's a good way to make sure that huge corporations cannot take over. So there really is a diversity of approaches going on here. And I think that if we're going to be serious about combating this problem, we really have to try a lot of different things all at once.
It's the 21st Show. I'm Christine Herman, and we're talking with Megan Greenwell, journalist and author of Bad Company, Private Equity and the Death of the American Dream. Just another 5 minutes or so, but our number is 800-222-9455 if you'd like to join this conversation, 800-222-9455. Megan, with all the uncertainty right now in the American economy, what do you expect the future holds for private equity and the role it plays in our economy? Do you expect it to continue growing? And maybe you can put this into context for us a little bit. Has it been growing? Like, what's the trend over the past, you know, decade or two? And then what do you see happening in the going forward?
The trend is just up and up and up and up. The exact industries that are the biggest areas of focus do change, but private equity is indisputably swallowing more and more of the American economy every year. Private equity firms have tried to present this moment as sort of an existential moment for them because interest rates are high, right? So there isn't a lot of cheap money available in the way that there was, you know, in 2020 or in 2010 or several other points. And they've said, look, we need even more favorable treatment because otherwise we're going to go out of business. I think that is deliberately overstated. You know, they want everybody to think that they are in dire straits such that we, yeah, give them even more perks. It is true that deal making in private equity is down, but it is impossible for me to see any world in which that is anything more than like a brief dip that represents a blip in the overall trend line going up. So I think, you know, we are very likely to see much more investment in public utilities and service providers, as well as in healthcare, because healthcare is sort of the ultimate recession-proof industry. We need it no matter how the economy is doing. Same with housing. And so, you know, without action, as soon as, you know, interest rates are inherently cyclical, they will go back down. And so as soon as they do, you'll see this new explosion in private equity investments, unless we get serious about regulation.
I wonder if you can pull back the curtain for a bit, given how much secrecy kind of surrounds these companies, these private equity companies. What was it like for you as a reporter trying to dig into this and get answers and information, given those challenges?
Very few private equity workers would speak to me on the record for this book. There are many of them in the book, but all off the record. The executive from KKR who I mentioned was the only person who gave me a really in-depth interview with his name attached. I was very grateful for that. But I did talk to a lot of folks, especially sort of on the rank and file level, you know, the people in entry-level jobs in private equity who are doing a lot of the grunt work on these deals. So they see all of the ins and outs of these deals. But getting people to speak on the record was very close to impossible. I think there's a version of this book that really dives deep inside the firms and their deal making. And that was not a book I found it possible to report. Ultimately, I found it more fruitful to focus on the experience of workers and tenants anyway. But yes, this is a very secretive group of people who does not want reporters or the rest of us to know what is going on.
And it's a very captivating and compelling read, the way you weave the stories of these four different people together. I found it to be fascinating. So in the just a couple minutes we have left here, what is your hope for people who read this book? What do you hope they take away from it?
The main thing is I hope readers, you know, are really compelled by my four characters, because I think they're just fascinating people with interesting stories to tell, and that they then feel empowered to learn, first and foremost, learn about private equity's role in their own life. So figure out if your local hospital is owned by private equity. Figure out if that's had any effects for you as a patient. Figure out if they're involved in your public utilities in your municipality, and maybe try to talk to your representatives about whether that is a good system or a bad system. I am not an activist. I am not, you know, this is not a polemic kind of book. My role, I think, was to show clearly what is going on, show the range of what some people are doing about it, and hopefully inspire people to get the information, maybe come up with creative solutions of their own in their own home community or their employer or whatever it is. And then, you know, I get to kind of sit back and watch as people take the information and run with it.
Well, we really appreciate you joining us on the 21st show today. Megan Greenwell is a journalist. She's the author of the new book, Bad Company, Private Equity and the Death of the American Dream. It's available now wherever you get your books. Megan, thank you so much for sharing your work with us today on the 21st show.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
And that's all the time we have for today. Coming up on tomorrow's show, it's almost back to school season for many families. And while national headlines scream about teacher shortages, the data shows much more nuance. Some schools are hiring more than ever, while others can't fill open and necessary jobs, especially in some rural parts of the state. We'll discuss it in detail to understand what's real and what's not. Plus, the Illinois State Fair is back in town. We'll preview what to expect from this year's fair. That's next time on the 21st show. Before you go, please consider joining our texting group. It's the most popular way for listeners to share comments and questions on the show. You can join by sending the word TALK, that's T-A-L-K, to 217-803-0730. Again, text the word TALK to 217-803-0730. We appreciate hearing from you about our programs. We love hearing suggestions for future guests or stories, and you can send us an email at talk@21stshow.org. You can find that address and every other way to contact us, including our voicemail line, on our website, 21stshow.org. That's 21stshow.org. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield, Harrison Malkin, and Jose Zepeda. Layli Nazarova is an associate producer, and our digital producer is Kulsum Khan. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Christine Herman, in for Brian Mackey. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk with you again tomorrow.